Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about political corruption in the state of Illinois. According to a report issued earlier this year by the University of Illinois at Chicago, specifically by the Department of Political Science, the city of Chicago leads the nation in public corruption and the state ranks in third place. Why does our state get such high ratings on corruption, and how might Illinois politics be changed to enforce more ethical behavior on the part of politicians? Those are the questions we'll try to take up this morning in this hour of Focus, and we have joining us two guests, both by telephone. Dick Simpson is professor and head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is one of the authors of this report that came out in February. Also joining us by telephone is David Morrison. He is deputy director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform. He supervises the organization's research, writing, and website content, and also lobbies on behalf of their reform agenda. And perhaps I should also mention that Professor Simpson is particularly interested in Chicago politics, in state and local politics, and in the topic of public corruption. He has been a guest previously on this program. We're very pleased to have him with us once again. Also very pleased to have Dave Morrison as the guest on the show, too. So as we talk, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief just so we could keep things moving along. But anybody can call 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also have email. If you'd like to send in a thought that way, you certainly can. And that's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. At any point, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Simpson, hello.
Good morning.
And to our second guest here, Mr. Morrison, hello.
Oh, great to be here.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. Well, I think I'd like to just talk a little bit about the report and go on the two levels here. And what you're doing here, you're basing your ranking of the city and also of the state on convictions. Perhaps people don't need to be reminded of this, but let's talk a little bit about it anyway. As far as statewide elected officials are concerned, Professor Simpson, what are we looking at?
Well, since 1976, there have been 1,848, mostly public officials, a few businessmen, convicted of public corruption in trials. Those offenses have gone very far. Four of the last seven governors have been convicted, 31 of the aldermen in the Chicago City Council, and so on and so forth. It occurs throughout the state. We have a new report that will be coming out in a few weeks that particularly focuses on suburban corruption. Usually it's been thought that all the corruption in the state is just the city of Chicago. But the example of the comptroller stealing $53 million in Dixon, Illinois, the example of more than 130 people we've identified in the suburbs as convicted, suggests that this is not just the Chicago way, but the Illinois way of politics.
And these are people that clearly are taking advantage of their positions.
Yes,
to be able to enrich themselves?
Yeah, public corruption or government corruption is usually defined as a public official using their office to enrich themselves or their neighbors, friends, family. That is, they're getting a private benefit, and sometimes in the case of Blagojevich, their campaign contributors are, for helping the politician. Not to do public good, but to gain private wealth.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to David Morrison. This is, I'm sure, something that would not, even at the time that this report came out, this would not be news to you particularly. What about this is important?
You know, what Professor Simpson and his team have done that's fantastic is compile in one place a listing of all of the instances where public officials and sometimes their private contributors have gotten into trouble and been convicted. There's a broad sense that corruption is a big problem in this state, but until you know where it's happening and why it's happening, it's much harder to figure out solutions to that kind of thing. And so on that level, what he's put together is really wonderful.
Mm-hmm. This is certainly something that got national coverage, but at the same time, I could imagine that many people around the state of Illinois, when they heard this, that that Chicago among cities ranks number one in terms of corruption, and the state of Illinois ranks highly among the states. There might, among many Illinoisans, there might have been a collective shrug because they would have said something like, well, you know, that's kind of old news, isn't it? And it's disturbing that people should take that kind of attitude. But in fact, that is, it seems, the attitude that a lot of people have. That's just, well, that's just the way it is here in Illinois.
Well, we have a culture of corruption, and citizens are a part of that as well as public officials. That is, citizens expect their public officials to accept bribes, and public officials expect to get bribes in one form or another for what they do in their public life. And that culture of corruption goes back a long time. The first conviction for corruption was in 1869, 150 years ago. It was both Cook County commissioners and city council aldermen in Chicago who were convicted of a corrupt contract that isn't all that different except in the amount of money as the corrupt contracts that people are going to jail for today.
That just, one has to wonder, it cannot, certainly as you have found, it's not Illinois and Chicago, not the only places where there are political corruption. There are other places that have been noted for it at particular
actually,
times.
We've started a big contest. Florida just released a report saying they're really number one if you count only the years 2000 to 2010.
Is that the kind
of... They're trying to fix corruption in Florida. New Jersey and even Massachusetts and other states have been arguing, no, they're more corrupt than we are. It really isn't a prize we want to continue to win.
Well, that's it. Yes, I was just about to say, is that kind of the thing that you really want to have bragging rights on, the amount of corruption? And I suppose that what you're suggesting is it's someone there arguing that's really bad so that then they can turn around and argue that they're actually going to do something about it, or that they are doing something about it.
Yes, as David can detail, we've, after Blagojevich's indictment and being thrown out as governor by impeachment before his conviction, the state of Illinois put together a quite wonderful panel on ethics, and the Ethics Reform Commission issued a report. Only part of it, and a small part, got implemented, and Chicago, under Mayor Emanuel, has just created a Mayor's Ethics Task Force, which has issued a report, half of which has come out, and has yet to be introduced as legislation in Chicago. But we are making steps forward, but they're too incremental, they're too few, and they don't add up to the total change that would be required to end corruption in Illinois.
Yeah, let me, I'll turn again here to David Morrison, because as Professor Simpson just said, that in the wake of the allegations against former Governor Blagojevich, Governor Quinn put together this reform commission. The chairman was Patrick Collins, a well-respected former federal prosecutor. The commission had hearings, issued a report, came up with a number of recommendations. Tell me, maybe you might want to talk a little bit about, first of all, what the commission concluded, and then of those things the commission recommended, what were actually adopted?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a general sense in government that if something's not broken, there's no reason to fix it. So reform of government tends to be scandal-driven. When George Wyon was arrested at the culmination of Operation Safe Roads, that sparked a certain level of reform efforts by the House and Senate in Springfield. And when Rod Blagojevich was arrested, that again prompted a second round of reform. I don't know that you're ever going to find some magic statute that makes everybody better. The broader solution is going to be a cultural shift where voters and politicians themselves look to government in different ways. But we have seen, I would say, a broad sweep of statutory changes that have helped us move in that direction, both in response to the George Wyon scandals and also in response to the Rob Blagojevich issues.
Uh-huh.
The governor's a reform commission issued a wide-sweeping statement in 2009 listing 100 or so different things that the state could do or should do, including campaign finance reform, government transparency, changes to the procurement code and how the government buys goods and services. And many of those were enacted in fairly short order right after Blagojevich's arrest.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot more to do, of course. And I don't want to put too much pressure on statute, because statute sets out bold lines where you can't go. But it also relies on prosecutors to step in and say, no, this politician's gone too far, this public official has overstepped that. The time that we know that we have actually solved the problem is when prosecutors don't have to get involved anymore, and when public officials are no longer even thinking of stepping over those lines.
Let me just follow up on one point that you mentioned and go back over to Professor Simpson. One of the recommendations of this commission was indeed that we should have some campaign finance reform, and it was the case at that time that Illinois had the distinction of having no limits at all on how much money you could give to a political candidate. Now, subsequently, there also was another commission, a separate commission, just looking at campaign finance, and we did get some reform there, although I think not as much as perhaps some people would like. So in your mind, how much does do problems with campaign finance ultimately end up leading to problems with corruption?
Well, they're very important. Usually the higher the office, the more likely that the campaign contributions are the centerpiece of the problem. In the case of Chicago aldermen, for instance, most Chicago aldermen who've been convicted, the 31 of them, have taken small bribes, about $500, for zoning changes in the suburbs. That's been a rather continuing pattern, except more often it's with the mayors or town presidents in the suburbs than the aldermen, because they have more power over zoning and development. So those are one level of problem, and they don't have to do primarily with campaign finance. But when you run for higher office, like Rod Blagojevich did for governor and wanted to run for president, then you have to raise many millions of dollars, maybe $20 million to run effectively for governor. Then at that point, you begin to look for large campaign contributors, and they are more likely to want to have contracts or favors of substantial nature for their campaign contributions. So we do have an epidemic problem of corrupt campaign finance, but that's not the only cause of corruption.
Let me introduce again the guests for this hour of Focus. We are talking with Dick Simpson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and also David Morrison. He's deputy director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform. And we're talking about political corruption in the state of Illinois, partly because Department of Political Science there at University of Illinois Chicago issued a report back in February taking a look at corruption in Chicago and in the state of Illinois, concluding that Chicago was ranked number one in corruption among cities, and that Illinois ranked number third. And as Professor Simpson explained, there are people actually battling for higher places on this ranking. Also, he explained that sometime coming up soon here, there'll be another report looking at, is this the collar counties or the areas around Chicago that you're talking about?
Yes. We're looking primarily at the six counties in Illinois that surround Chicago, although we do have a few that drift over into Indiana and to Wisconsin. The amazing thing we found is that we found convictions for corruption in 67 of the towns and villages. Most people think of the suburbs as being very clean, and it's all the bad, evil Chicago that's the problem. The truth in Illinois is that corruption is endemic throughout the state. We had many cases earlier in our earlier reports of state officials and downstate officials who had been convicted. There's certainly famous ones like Paul Powell as Secretary of State, the four former governors in the last three decades and so forth that are well known, but there are also state legislators, there are people in smaller towns, like the famous case now of Dixon, the birthplace of Ronald Reagan, where the comptroller stole $53 million.
That's just when I first read that story, and then the subsequent stories where the calculation was that the amount had been even more than initially reported. It's truly staggering how that was even possible. I imagine probably people in Dixon were surprised they even had that much money to be stolen in the first place.
Well, in the case of Bridgeview, which the Tribune reported this last weekend, they have had their property taxes triple because of the way investments were made in the creating of the fire home stadium, the Toyota Stadium. And it is a matter in which those were plowed back in to contracts with members of families, rent to the mayor and state senator. Corruption can have, people think about corruption as not having a price, but in fact, as you get in the case of the $53 million in Dixon or the additional debt of $195 million in Bridgeview that has tripled their property taxes already and is likely to continue to increase their property taxes, it's a significant problem. We pay for corruption not only in money. In the case of George Ryan, there were the lost lives for the truckers who shouldn't have had their licenses. There's a loss of faith in government, the unwillingness to pay taxes because you think that the government is just stealing them. There are many costs to corruption, and they're probably ones we no longer want to pay.
Yeah. Well, I have a caller here who's been patient. I'd like to bring them into the conversation. And this is someone who's listening in Charleston, and it's our line number 4. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Yes.
You mentioned George Ryan, and that's my question. There seemed, I think I remember on the news, some push to release him early. And I was wondering if you would include that as part of the complacency Illinois has for corruption, that they were already, I mean, he hasn't even served that long of a sentence. They're already trying to push to release him. Or is his early release a separate issue and not really wrapped up in our complacency? So I guess in a more pointed question, if we're really serious about, you know, stamping down on corruption, should we carry out the sentence as prescribed by the courts?
Well, I think in general, there should be a general policy of zero tolerance. One of the things that should happen is that when corrupt individuals are caught, whether or not they've broken the law, they should be fired as public officials, and possibly their boss who failed to catch the corruption should be at least punished and maybe fired, but at least punished in a significant way for failing their fiduciary responsibility. In terms of sentences, the George Ryan thing hinges on a couple of different questions about the change in Supreme Court rules. It has to do with his health, has to do with his wife's death while he was in prison, and so forth. One could make humanitarian or legal arguments for going ahead and releasing him. But in general, he got a significant sentence. And, of course, Rod Blagojevich got a much longer sentence for corruption. I think the courts have run out of patience with corrupt officials and are giving longer sentences. And most of those are carried out. In the federal prison system, you don't get much time off for good behavior. You have to serve the whole term.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Mr. Morrison, did you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, I was going to say the issue with George Ryan, his defense team has been pushing for him to get out since he was convicted. What's been happening lately in his case is, as Professor Simpson said, there's been some shift in legal terrain, whether the honest services law, as it's called in federal statutes, applies to these kinds of cases. George's team is saying, oh, he should be let out because the change in the statute. The Supreme Court ruling in that matter makes clear that when someone has taken bribes, the statute does apply. And that certainly is the case with George Ryan. He was convicted of taking money that he shouldn't have taken. And so I'm confident that whatever his legal team says, he will stay in prison as long as he should.
All right. Let's go to another caller. Matt Toon, next. Line number 1. Hello.
Good morning. My question is, how about the prosecutor's office?
Well, there are two sets of problems. The U.S. attorney has been very vigorous, and all of the convictions I was talking about have come through the U.S. attorney's office. State's attorneys and the attorney general have not been vigorous. Essentially, they've prosecuted no corruption. That's particularly true in Cook County with the Cook County state's attorney, but it's even true with Lisa Madigan and the attorney general's office. And the reason they normally give is that they don't have the proper tools. They don't have the ability to do wiretap like the federal government does. They don't have FBI agents, and they don't have accountants who can do the kind of complicated research that's required. I find those arguments unconvincing. I think that state's attorneys and attorney generals ought to prosecute more corruption, because there simply aren't enough forces with the U.S. Attorney's Office to handle all the corruption that there is. In addition, one positive step forward has been the appointment of inspector generals. There's some very good inspector generals, such as the ones in Chicago. There's some weak attorney generals, inspector generals, who aren't doing a very good job. But a problem for inspector generals is they can find a waste or corruption, and they can point it out to the government, but they have no enforcement powers. And in some cases, depending on the inspector general, for instance, the Chicago City Council inspector general is toothless and worthless and should be abolished, and should be, the office ought to be given over to the regular city inspector general, but the aldermen aren't willing to do that. So it gets to be a thorny area, but the one thing that should happen is citizens should be demanding of those who have prosecutorial power, such as the state's attorney and the attorney general, that they vigorously prosecute corruption and not leave it entirely to the U.S. attorney.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
On that score, one of the goals of the statutory changes that came after George Ryan was to create that inspector general system at the state level, to create an administrative process that could review complaints about corruption, and the goal was to have some, a system in place that could ferret out issues before they got too big. And that's worked reasonably well. We've had a couple of improvements that we had to make over the last couple of years. The very first inspectors general, of course, were appointed by the very same people they were investigating. And despite requiring a Senate confirmation, there were some concerns there that the people were not going to be as vigorous as they should. Over time, I think some of those concerns have gone away, and we've seen that they are some pretty good people. But it's always going to take vigilance to make sure that people don't take advantage of public offices.
Well, let me just ask here. I guess I'll start with the Professor Simpson. As you mentioned, the man really who has been the most effective and the most aggressive agent of going after corruption has been Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney for the Northern District there in Chicago. He's been on the job since September of 2001 and recently announced that he was going to step down. And I think that there has been a lot of concern about who would replace him and whether whoever that person was would indeed be as aggressive as he had been.
That is important, but we've actually had a long list of U.S. attorneys going back to Jim Thompson when he was a U.S. attorney and convicted people like Tom Keene and others back in the early 70s. And it's been almost a straight line. Every U.S. attorney we've had has been vigorous. Undoubtedly, the current U.S. attorney has been the most vigorous. They've gone from one team of public corruption in the office to two teams, so that they're able to do more cases and to do them more broadly. But I'm pretty confident that we're going to get a new U.S. attorney who's going to have that as part of their agenda. It certainly ought to be the criteria that the senators and the president will use in making the selection is a very important part.
Hmm. Anything you might want to add to that, Mr. Morrison?
Yeah, we have had a strong string. Scott Lazar and Jim Burns, before the current holder of that office, were great. Safe Roads did not begin with Fitzgerald. I mean, he finished it off and then took off with Operation Board Games that brought down Rob Blagojevich. We have a strong history in that office. Some of the problem with state offices, though, is that we do rely too much on U.S. attorneys. When Lisa Madigan, as Attorney General, began poking around with Rob Blagojevich, she got a rather famous letter now in June of 2006 saying, please back off, you're interfering with our investigation, from the U.S. attorney. And so it's difficult to balance those kind of relationships. In some ways, having a strong U.S. attorney has allowed local prosecutors to step back from those cases.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that in the report that I mentioned here now a couple of times that Professor Simpson was involved in, when you come around to the point of making recommendations, you know, you referred to a proposal by the governor to allow citizens, Illinois citizens, to adopt ethics reforms by referendum. Now, does that mean that you think that ultimately politicians, elected officials, aren't going to do this on their own, and that it's going to have to be citizen pressure to force them to deal with this?
I think in the long run, to change the culture of corruption, citizens are going to have to be much more vigorous. And it's not, I think the politicians will do some steps, but only if the citizens are demanding it. You know, it even goes to electing politicians who both run on platforms of reform, but actually carry out the reforms once they're in office. And that's really a task that citizens have to undertake. But even more broadly, I think it's the next generation of citizens as well as the current generation. I'm very disturbed that, for instance, the Chicago schools have taken civics out of the curriculum. Many of the other schools in the state have just a token one so they can pass the required state constitution test, but don't really. They might teach their three branches of government, but that isn't what we need at this point. We need to have the students reading books like Pat Collins on corruption and reform in Illinois. We need to know the costs of corruption. We need to know the cures of corruption. As David has said, there have been a number of reports, nearly all of them more or less agree as to what has to be done to curb corruption. And it's now, though, the will of the citizens. An example that would be like it is Daniel Burnham did the famous plan of Chicago in 1909, but it wasn't because of that plan that everything happened. A man named Wacker produced a Wacker manual that was used in the public schools for generations, and that created the citizenry and the civic leaders who were willing to put the bridge over Michigan at Michigan Avenue. They were willing to make the park system, willing to do the diagonal streets that were boulevards, and all of the other improvements that made Chicago a beautiful city in comparison to what it was in the 19th century. So we need the same kind of push in ethics, and that has to start with the citizenry becoming involved now and pushing, and it has to be training the next generation of citizens. It's a 10 or 20-year process to totally eliminate the culture of corruption we have and have a culture of honest, effective government. Mm.
We are at a point here where we need to take a very short break. We're having a conversation this morning about political corruption in the state of Illinois. We have several other callers that we will continue with and also talk some more with our guests, Dick Simpson and David Morrison. We'll do that after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jams, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics every week. In the second hour today, our guest will be poet-journalist Ananda Rose. We will talk about her book, Showdown in the Sonoran Desert, which takes a look at people who are getting at the issue of illegal immigration from really two very different and completely opposed ways, from people who think that people who are undocumented and who come here risking their lives to get into the United States should be helped. Our people on the other side who say, no, in fact, they're breaking the law. We should do everything we can to prevent them from breaking the law. And the question is, well, where's the motivation? And she finds, interestingly enough, religion an important motivator for people on both sides of this controversy. Then tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the future of coal as an energy source. And we'll have two guests here from the University of Illinois, Masood Rostam Abadi, who is a professor of engineering, and also Scott Elrick from the Illinois State Geological Survey. Check the schedule at our website, will.illinois.edu. Find out what we'll do in the days ahead. You can also follow us on Twitter, Will Public Media. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about political corruption in the state of Illinois. We have two guests. Dick Simpson, he is professor and head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's interested in Chicago politics, state and local politics, public corruption. And he is also one of the authors of a report that just came out in February, looking at political corruption in the state of Illinois. This was published by the Department of Political Science at the U of I and also the Illinois Integrity Initiative of the U of I's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Also joining us is David Morrison. He's deputy director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, does a number of things, supervises research there, lobbies on behalf of their reform agenda. They're both joining us by phone. Questions are welcome, and we have several people we'll bring into the conversation now. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call, and thanks to your guests for the work that they're doing on behalf of all of us. I'm looking for more specifics that your guests might be able to mention about what the citizenry can actually do. There have been recently two op-eds in the local newspaper talking about addressing corruption and inefficiency in Illinois government, and another one focusing on the gambling industry as opposed taxing them as opposed to taxing the citizenry to make up for or deal with the current economics of the state. We may need long-term solutions, but we also need some immediate solutions because the politicians are addressing problems that they have largely created by their lack of attentiveness to corruption and greed and inefficiency in the state by taxing the people of Illinois, by taking away services, life-saving services from the people of Illinois, by reneging on the agreements for retirement that people have worked their entire lives for. So we need some immediate action. And that does not seem to be coming from Springfield or Chicago. You mentioned the citizenry. What can they do now to get more effective government, but not at the expense of the people that government is supposed to serve?
Well, to begin with, you're quite correct. There is a financial cost of corruption. Our estimate so far is it's about $500 million a year cost to the taxpayer with corrupt contracts, patronage, bribes, and so forth.
Pat Collins' estimate was much, much higher. It was in the billions of dollars in his report of the Illinois Reform Commission.
Yes, and BGA also thinks it's a higher number. None of the details, but there are reasons that none of us have been able to do an exact count, because if you factor in things like deaths caused by shoddy inspections and the rest, it takes a full economics team to do so, and we've not been able to afford it. There's actually very little money available to the organizations that work on corruption. But to get to your specific question about what can be done, there are several steps. If one lived in Chicago, there's Ethics Task Force recommendations is a significant step forward. In other cities such as yours, I would suspect you would want to make sure track process is fair and that it's transparent and that there is information on the website to allow citizens to actually look at major contracts that are being let to see if they're going to insider political people. I'll let David speak about where we are in the reforms at the state level. But at every level of government, there are specific steps that can move forward curbing corruption. If you don't have inspector generals, and I don't know, I know none of the suburbs do. I don't know downstate on the towns. One of the problems is those units are too small in many cases to have inspector generals. There are the need for inspector generals who cover all of these areas so that they can look into waste and corruption on behalf of the citizens.
Yeah, if I can chime in with some things you might do, or mm-hmm. one thing people should stop doing is stop accepting answers from public officials who say, You know, I paved your street. I changed the light bulbs in the alley. You should be thrilled. I mean, you should expect that kind of service. You shouldn't be thrilled to get that kind of service. And so the first thing people should do is stop letting people get away with simple solutions to issues and start setting your own agenda when meeting with candidates. If voters show up at candidate debates or at public forums and ask questions about these issues, politicians start paying attention. If you start calling your state legislators, your local officials, your mayors, your aldermen, whoever, and tell them you care about this, just pick up the phone and make a call. That right there can change the dynamic between constituents and public officials. And the more that people take that basic step of letting officials know what voters want them to do, the more accountable they're going to be.
Well, I've done all of those things that you've suggested, and although the local politicians are quite personable and will take the time to chat with you, little gets done because they're also part of a system that is greased by a political system which is overall corrupt. And so recourse such as that is not available. The Chicago newspapers won't publish op-eds on this issue. And so we're really in a bind, and now it's coming at the expense of the state legislators taking away life-saving services from people to make amends for their failures in the past.
Well, on that note, if one person is not enough, then bring five. And if five doesn't do it, then bring 15.
If a group does get together and agree on a reform agenda for two or three or five things that need to be done specifically, and you can get the list from Pat Collins' report or from my website. If you Google Chicago Politics at University, you'll see our five anti-corruption reports, each of which have specific recommendations related to different aspects of corruption. You can do it from the Chicago Mayor's Task Force on Ethics Reform. If you pick out three or four specific things you want to work on and you work with a group, say, in Chicago, like David's group or like BGA or IVIIPO, downstate, I'm not sure I can tell you which groups, but if a group agrees to an agenda and works with the officials to push those, generally the officials will bend. And that will begin to curb some of the worst contract expenses, which is one of the ways, and the useless projects that are done for friends. Those kinds of things can add up to millions of dollars very quickly. And as you say, make that money available to pay for retirements and pay for services that are necessary for citizens.
We just have about 10 minutes left. I appreciate the comments of the caller. I have some others I want to get to. I want to make sure we get them in the time that we have left. So we'll go on to Champaign County. This is the next person here, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I share some of the earlier sentiments from the previous caller. I think there's a lot of stuff going under the color of law in Illinois that I think, unethical, but no, there's no law against it. Our tax policy, corporate, et cetera. But I wanted to ask you specifically, what is the breakdown of what are the sorts of corruptions? And the notorious ones that we see is somebody in a small government who just starts writing checks and finding ways to move funds around, and they eventually get found out. But pay-to-play, you sort of pointed at it. The other side of this is more transparency so that these pay-to-pay plans can't be done without scrutiny. And I think there's anything let out, request for proposal, more than a certain amount of money is typically published. But I don't know if there's any provision for follow-up and et cetera. I just think that a lot of people don't have time in their regular lives to call in shows and to follow down the, you know, what who's getting which can we have?
Well, and that
go, go ahead. Thank you. Right.
What they're counting on, I think, is that if they think voters are too busy to pay attention or aren't aware of what's going on, then they're more inclined to listen to the lobbyists or the campaign contributors or the people who are in their face all the time. But if voters speak up and say, no, we really do care about this, then that gets their attention. So it's just speaking up and being in touch with officials, making phone calls, sending emails, signing petitions, that still works. It may take more people than it used to. It may take more effort than it used to, but it does get their attention.
The biggest single problem politically is the existence of political machines. The Democratic machine in Chicago, usually the Republican machine in the suburbs and downstate, varies a little bit by place in the state. But those political machines foster patronage. They foster inside dealers. They foster the pay-to-play. And one simple alternative is to elect alternative candidates to the machine candidates, whether they're reformers within the party or independent candidates. And there are a number of organizations that work at doing that. But machine politics directly leads to the graft and corruption, and it has for the last 150 years.
All right. Another caller, Savoy, line number 3. Hello.
Good morning. I have a few percentage questions here, but first let me clear up. The ranking that you've given here for Chicago being the worst, or the best of the worst, I guess, and Illinois being third, that covers what years now?
Covers from 1976 to 2010. Those are the 2010 is the latest figures available.
Okay, thank you.
And that's over that entire span of time.
What state's number 2?
I'd have to pull the report if you hang on just a second.
And what state's number 1?
Well, the ones in 1 and 2 were actually small places. They were the District of Columbia and Louisiana. They both have small populations. And the District of Columbia comes in first because the federal government likes to try a lot of their cases there in Washington because it's easy for them. Louisiana is a legitimate contender, but they have only like 2 million people in the state.
So Louisiana is number 2.
That's about right. I'd have to look, and you can look on the
In terms of the percentage of these offenders,
our state, Louisiana, and New Jersey, who always come in 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The order may change, but that's where the...
What did you say about New Jersey, sir?
Oh, that the three states that are most commonly cited for having corruption issues are ours, Louisiana, and New Jersey. The ranking may vary a little bit, but that's
okay.
Where the problem lies.
Now, what percent of these offenders were in elected office?
I don't know that we've ever calculated that, but it's more than 30%. I don't know whether it's 50%. It might well be.
I think that'd be very important to calculate. What percentage were appointed office holders?
The others, except for a handful of businessmen who gave the bribes. In general, I don't think there have been more than 10 or 20 businessmen convicted. There may be a handful more, but nearly all of these are government officials.
Part of what struck me about the U.S. Attorney's march through Operation Safe Road was the way that they went from the low-level kind of front desk people who were taking bribes to give out driver's licenses and went straight up the chain, convicting and arresting people all the way through the middle management up to the governor. So it wasn't just the elected official, but it was all the people around the elected official who made that corruption possible. And they followed a similar pattern on a somewhat smaller scale with the Rod Blagojevich board games conviction. The message there is that it's not just the public officials who are corrupt. It's the system around them. But also that if you're, say, a campaign volunteer or someone who works in government or works around government and facilitates corruption, just because your name is not on the door doesn't mean you're safe. The U.S. Attorney is going after all sorts of people who are involved in these kinds of schemes.
Okay. Now, the next question I have is, what percent are these are Democrats and what percent are Republicans?
Well, I can tell you they include both.
Sure.
We've, again, not run a percentage on that basis.
Please.
But we're finding in our current suburban report there seem to be it's equal opportunity corruption, that places like DuPage County, they're run by the Republicans. The people are Republican, and then people like, say, Chicago, they're mostly Democrats.
Well, there's certainly...
So there are more Democrats than Republicans, but we've not found any great distinction between one party being the clean, good government party and the other party being the bad party.
Well, these are certainly things that will change over years of time, I suppose, but I think we need to have that precisely for this shot in time that you're giving us. I would like to add one idea. I think everybody should realize that deep down state Illinois is highly Democrat, perhaps with roots going all the way back to the Civil War.
Sure, East St. Louis and the rest, sure.
So you really can't think of downstate as purely Republican. You just can't.
And it's the same true upstate, and like I say, in the suburban area, places like DuPage County are Republican, and places like Chicago are Democrat.
We just, again, I want to thank the caller. We have just about 5 minutes, so we just got another caller in, so we want to get to them. This is Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Hello. I guess it's an anecdote that I would like to contribute in reference to the previous caller was asking about Republican versus Democrat. After the Nixon-Kennedy election, Nixon wanted a recount in Illinois. It was very close. And Eisenhower put the kibosh on it because he knew that there was more miscounting of Republican votes than there were of Democrats. I think it was something like 20,000 to 40 or 50,000. So for a long time, it's been a bipartisan effort for corruption. Thank you.
All right. Well, yes, I'm not exactly sure it's very productive wanting to count heads one way or another when we know that it's a big problem overall. Let me just, we're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left here. I guess something I'm interested in, and it actually was something I wanted to raise, and Professor Simpson mentioned it, was civic education. And I was struck by, in fact, an opinion piece that I just came across that came out a couple of months ago that happened to be written by Jim Ryan, no relation to George Ryan. This is Jim Ryan, the former attorney general. And this appeared in the Daily Herald newspaper. And he mentioned that same thing. He mentioned that there were 44 states that require at least a semester of coursework in civics or government as a high school graduation requirement. And Illinois, he notes, is one of six states that has no such provision. Because, Professor Simpson, you talked a little bit about it, let me just ask Dave Morrison, do you really think something like that would be helpful?
Well, anything that gets voters more involved is definitely a good thing. The more that people reach out to their public officials, the more responsive they're going to be. I don't know that high school civics is necessarily the best place to teach it. Those same kind of messages can be delivered through a news media, through a candidates themselves can foster that kind of culture. I have to say I used to work in government in Connecticut and was struck there that there was a real expectation on the part of state legislators that they would have to knock on every voter's doors. And districts there were small enough that a candidate really could knock on just about every voter's door between Labor Day and Election Day. Here in Illinois, there are 13 million people. A state house district is 100,000 residents. It's physically not possible to have that kind of connection. But there are still things that voters can do to reach out to their officials, to stay in touch, to make sure that the official knows who's watching.
Well, I want to turn back here real quick to Professor Simpson. In the same piece, Mr. Ryan, former Attorney General, also points out that Rod Blagojevich was reelected in 2006, even though at the time he was under investigation by the U.S. Attorney, and that was something that was not a secret. It had been reported in the media. But one wonders whether, in fact, that specific case, or with anything else that has to do with corruption, whether we, in the news media, are doing our job to highlight it.
Well, it was pretty well known that there were a lot of problems with Blagojevich, but Judy Bart Topinka's campaign was overwhelmed, particularly because the money that Blagojevich had was enough to buy all the TV ads necessary to saturate the state, mm-hmm. and there was that unfortunate video of Judy Bart Topinka dancing with Governor Ryan, who had been convicted and gone to jail at that point.
So it was a little bit of circumstance, but yes, the voters have often made bad choices. That's not always possible to correct for in the short term, but is in the long term. On the matter of the civic education, we need to not only teach the mechanics of government, we need to do what's called civic or political engagement, help students understand how they work with community groups, neighborhood groups, how they get involved in politics, how campaigns are run, how laws are actually passed and practiced, and engage them perhaps in internships as we do at the university, where they get a chance to see things firsthand and to begin to develop a habit of lifelong involvement. We're going to have to take the state back if we want to have a different kind of state.
Well, we, I think, are at the point where we're going to have to finish up. Again, to thank our guests, Dick Simpson, who is professor of political science at University of Illinois, and Dave Morrison from the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform. Professor Simpson, you just mentioned a website that people could go to if they would like to read your reports on corruption.
Yes, they can either go through the University of Illinois at Chicago website to political science and click on Chicago politics, or they can Google Chicago politics at university. And either will get them to my website, which has five anti-corruption reports. We'll soon have a sixth, and including the one you've been citing. Mm-hmm. And then there are a variety of other studies of city council voting and other insights into politics as it works in the state.
All right. And I'm sure also if people are interested in the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, you just put that into your web browser and you can get to their website and find out what they're up to as well. David Morrison, thank you very much.
Sure, and we're online at ilcampaign.org.
Excellent. And Professor Simpson, thank you.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.